Matthew chapter 10, the second great discourse of the five discourses that uniquely identify Matthew. Matthew is structured uniquely, unlike any of the other Gospels, because it is structured around these five long extended talks that Jesus gives. We spent quite a while on that first extended talk, the Sermon on the Mount. We've now come to the second extended talk. And to set the stage for this, it's very interesting. I've read a lot on church, church life, church leadership, and you'll find there is no end to the amount of material you can read where leaders are struggling to find direction over what the church should be and what the church should do. They are looking as best they can for a manual for mission, something that will give some sense of what we're to be as the church. And what's wonderful is we have one. There is a manual for mission that is this second extended discourse, because this is Jesus' direct instructions to His sent out ones, to His disciples, to the church that gathers around Him and then scatters into the world over what they're to do and to be as Christ's community in the world. What's wonderful about this is we're now on the second extended discourse. Matthew is structured after five discourses. The first one, chapters 5 through 7, the Sermon on the Mount, how the disciples are to live the kingdom life in a fallen world. Then there's two chapters, and we looked at this last week, where Jesus does all kinds of works of power. He heals, He exorcises demons, He shows power over nature, He raises the dead. And all of that creates some great excitement and a little bit of controversy and some initial resistance to His message, which leads us to His attempt to try to expand His ministry by taking His inner circle and sending them out two by two to perform the works that He is doing, but to now do it on their own. He's been in the driver's seat up until now, but now He's sending His disciples out as interns. They're going to be in the driver's seat now, and they're going to be in charge of doing the works of the kingdom in the world as well. So Matthew chapter 10 is His extended instruction manual for what that mission is to look like, what it's to be like in this world. And in order to really look at 10 well, let's set the stage for that by going back to the end of chapter 9. This is actually where we left off last week. We ended with verse 34, with the rising controversy that is ensuing because the religious elite are not happy with all of the various people Jesus is ministering to. Gentiles, outsiders, lepers, people that are not the ones that really you focus on if you're trying to gain power and influence. So in verse 34, after Jesus heals a blind man and He's previously raised the dead, verse 34, the Pharisees say, "It's by the prince of demons that He drives out demons." So they never deny His power, and that's so important for understanding the miracles of Jesus. His enemies never say He's just lying, He's a charlatan, it's all a sham, He doesn't have any real power. They instead say, "Oh yeah, He has power, we can't deny that, but we will deny its source. Its source is not God, its source is the evil one." So that He is an agent of the evil one. So that's where these works of power end, with this rising controversy, which we all know is going to ultimately end at the cross. But before we get there, there's much more work to be done. And so in verse 35, we get a summary of what Jesus has been doing up till now with three main verbs. Verse 35, Jesus went through all the towns and villages, teaching in their synagogues, preaching the good news of the kingdom, and healing every disease and sickness. There's our three key words: preaching, teaching, and healing. Well, He's going through all the towns, and crowds are starting to amass. So in verse 36, when He saw the crowds, He had compassion on them. Why? Because they were harassed and helpless, like sheep without a shepherd. That phrase, sheep without a shepherd, is a common Old Testament phrase that refers to corrupt leaders. Leaders who are not exercising their duties responsibly. Leaders are using their power to exploit rather than to help. They're using their power to harm rather than to heal. This is a leaderless Israel, and because of it, the people are harassed and helpless. They're abused. They're wandering. They're aimless. They don't know who to follow. There's no one to follow. They don't know where to go. And I love Jesus' one-word response that you've already read there in verse 36. He had splankna. He had compassion. It is, you know, the Greek word actually sounds like something dropping into your stomach. Splankna. And it's this idea that deep in your bowels, deep in the core of your emotional center, you are touched. You are touched in such a way that you are moved, you feel empathy, and you have to do something. You're that deeply touched. So Jesus sees the crowds, he sees the injustice, he sees the hurt and the harm. And so verse 37, he says to his disciples, "The harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few." So he looks at the crowds and he compares them to a harvest. And you know what harvest means? It's not just cropland. It's time to harvest this thing. And when you say harvest is ready, what you're saying is it's urgent. You can't wait around. You can't sit around and collect your resources and think about what you should or shouldn't do. This is an urgent time with no time to waste. And if you don't harvest at the right time, you'll miss the harvest altogether. So that there's a need to get workers out to do something about these helpless and hurt people that have no leadership whatsoever. Then he says, in light of that, this urgent need with so much to do and so few to do it, in verse 38, "Ask the Lord of the harvest, therefore, to send out workers into his harvest field." Which you could paraphrase that with Jesus saying, pray that God will send some laborers out into the field. And oh, by the way, you're the answer to your prayers. So that he's inviting them to pray, and as we always say, be careful what you pray for. Because they are the answer to that prayer. They're not praying in some kind of way that says, hey, we're not equipped, we've not done this before, we don't know what to do, we don't have the resources, how can we cover all of this? Instead, they have this awareness that they're to pray, and now they're the answer. The answer to their prayers is that they are now to enter into the work of Jesus themselves and do the same work that Jesus has done so that the message of the kingdom can spread far and wide in a nation of Israel that is harassed and helpless without anyone to give any guidance. And this is where, for the first time in Matthew, we talk about the 12. We've seen a few disciples called here and there. We've seen about four or five of them, but we haven't seen the 12 yet. But here we are introduced to the idea of the 12 for the first time in chapter 10. He called his 12 disciples to him and gave them authority to drive out evil spirits and to heal every disease and sickness. So the same authority that he's been showing in those works of power, they are now given that same authority and power. And just so we know who these 12 are, Matthew lists them out for us. Here are the 12 disciples who are, for the first time in verse 2, called apostles. Apostle means sent ones, the ones who are sent out. Verse 2, these are the names of the 12 apostles. First, and who else could be first? Simon, who is called Peter, and his brother Andrew, James, son of Zebedee, and his brother John. And with those first four, you get three of the inner circle for Jesus: Peter, James, and John. There's a song in Jesus Christ Superstar called the Garden of Gethsemane song when he's about to go away and pray that prayer, "Father, if it's possible, remove this cup from me." And he says, "Will none of you stay awake with me? Peter, John, James," and that's how I always remember those three. Those are the inner circle. Those are his best friends among this other circle of very close friends that are the other nine apostles. And we get their names as well. And their names are a little bit more unique because there's three that stand out. Beginning at verse 3, Philip and Bartholomew, Thomas and Matthew, the tax collector, James, son of Alphaeus, and Thaddeus, Simon the Zealot, and Judas Iscariot, who betrayed him. The three names that stand out: Matthew, tax collector; working side by side with Simon the Zealot. A tax collector is, you know, part of the Roman Empire, part of that system that is oppressive to Israel, despised by Jews, the bottom feeders of the Roman system. Here is this one in league with Rome who's now working side by side with Simon the Zealot, who does not mind at all killing Romans in order to make sure Israel's nationalism reigns supreme. They want freedom, and they want freedom at all cost. If it takes destroying, killing, maiming, massacring, whatever it takes, they're ready to do that. So you've got a zealot, a nationalist, right beside someone who is in league with Rome. Then you add Judas Iscariot to the mix, and depending on what Iscariot means, some would say Iscariot means he's a man from Kerioth, but Iscariot is so awful close to the Greek word for dagger, which is used for assassins. And the idea is, again, the same as a zealot. You're willing to do whatever is needed in order to create terror, in order to shrug off the oppressive bonds of Rome. So if that means going into a center of a district, and there's a Roman official, you have your dagger, you have it hidden, you're an assassin. And you go out, and that creates the terror needed to hopefully eventually get the Romans to lay off and leave. So you've got possibly at least one zealot, maybe two zealots, alongside Matthew the tax collector, with a bunch of fishermen and other groups of folk. And you have a very interesting group of 12, because not only are they diverse and yet united under Jesus, somehow Jesus gets them to work side by side, but they are also nothing special. There's no Pharisees here. There's no religious elite. There's no scribes. There's no lawyers. There's no priests. There's no Levites. They're common folk. There's no one in the elite. And none of these, by the way, are impoverished either. They all are essentially in the middle class. They're common folk of their time, unschooled for the most part, common folk that Jesus has called to himself. But the word that's so important for this group of people is that word in verse 2, the 12. Because 12 has a deep and abiding sense for people that know their Hebrew Bible. The 12 tribes of Israel. It has this deep sense, and what scholars would say, and I agree wholeheartedly, is the Jesus calling 12 is a way to represent a new Israel. A new movement, the restoration of the 12, the beginning again of, you know, Israel and his 12 sons, Jacob and the 12. Now we have Jesus and his 12, and it is meant to symbolize a new restoration of what God has desired for the people of Israel found in these 12 individuals. And so now we have the 12, which leads then to the instructions. And the reason why I so adamantly see this as a manual for mission is notice how verse 5 is worded. These 12 Jesus sent out with, you ready? The following instructions. So the rest of this whole extended discourse is instruction on being sent out. Instruction on serving in the way of Jesus, partnering with Jesus, going out where the harvest is plentiful, where people are hurting and helpless and aimless, and entering into Jesus' kingdom ministry to both proclaim and to heal. And so these are the instructions. Instruction number one. Do not go among the Gentiles or enter any town of the Samaritans. Go rather to the lost sheep of Israel. Many people get concerned about that passage, but they forget how Matthew ends. Go into all the world and make disciples of all nations. The promise of the prophets had always been first to the Jew, then to the Greek. That God had made promises to Israel. God had decided that it was through a particular people that a universal redemption would come. Abraham is called so that he will be blessed, and in his blessing will be a blessing to the nations. So that salvation comes from Israel. Jesus says those kind of things in the Gospels. So we have this idea that the Gospel must first come to the Jew in order for it to have any impact for the Greek or anyone beyond. Now, what's interesting about Matthew, we've already seen two Gentiles approach Jesus. The Magi, who worship him when Herod's trying to kill him. And we saw the centurion, and Jesus was astonished. I've never seen faith like this in anyone else, remember? But both of those Gentiles approach Jesus. He doesn't go out seeking them. They take the initiative. He doesn't go out to seek them because the prophetic plan had always been that God had promised that God would bring salvation to Israel. And through that salvation to Israel would be bring blessing to the nations. So the point here is not to exclude the Gentiles. It's timing. It's what's the historical context here. The gospel's not just for Israel. It's for all the world. But it must be proclaimed first to Israel in order that they might hear it first. And if they reject it and it moves to the Gentiles, well, they've been given first hearing, which is what God had promised in the first place. So, by the time we get to the end of this book, go, the same language, go out, I'm sending you. And so, Matthew expects us to appropriate this as our manual for mission as the church as we go out into the world. So, go into all the world and make disciples of all nations. So, it expands because it has come. And now the seed, the blessing comes through the seed of Abraham. It comes through Jesus the Christ, the true Israelite, and then extends first to the Jew and then to all Gentiles. So that's the first that's given. That'll be modified by the end of the gospel to go into all the world, and so that becomes much more inclusive by the time we're done. If you want to summarize the main two words of mission, you get it in verse 7 and 8. As you go, here's the first verb, preach this message. The kingdom of heaven is near. We've already heard that message. John the Baptist preached it. Jesus preached it. Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is near. The gospel is never, you go to heaven when you die, so let's just talk about your eternal destiny. It is God is drawing near now. God is invading this world with His injustice and harm and helplessness and bringing hope and healing and life and all of that. So, the kingdom of heaven is drawing near. Make sure you preach this. So, you've got to preach something. But preaching without signs of the kingdom is just empty verbiage. So, He says, not only preach, verse 8, but heal. And for them, with apostolic authority, heal the sick, raise the dead, cleanse those who have leprosy, drive out demons. For us, we understand that same mandate to be there, perhaps not with the same apostolic signs, but the understanding that we come with a word that is not just a word of hope, but with hands of hope. That any kingdom message worth its salt cannot just be, repent, the kingdom of heaven is near. It must also be accompanied by signs of the kingdom, which is to help the helpless, to bring hope to the hopeless, to bring healing. It needs to have a whole range of human need involved. Which is why every missions board worth its salt doesn't just send out pastors and theology professors. They send out medical professionals and educators and doctors and, you know, on and on it goes, where they're thinking about the whole range of how we help a harassed and helpless people, of how we bring hope and mercy and healing and justice. So there's always a much larger scope. So that St. Francis, I actually have it hanging on my wall. I forget who gave me this wonderful quote, but it's a very popular quote from St. Francis. Preach the gospel at all times. If necessary, use words. I love the sentiment of that. Literally, I don't believe it, but I love the sentiment because you have to use words. Preach the gospel. Repent, the kingdom of heaven is near. You have to say that. That has to come out. You have to say it in a way that's culturally relevant or in a way that meets with people. But words must be spoken. But Matt Francis's sentiment is so true in that if it's only words, it's empty. So, make sure that you have done your best to make sure that the words are accompanied with signs. Because signs without words aren't the gospel, it's just social work. Words without signs aren't the gospel, it's just, you know, verbiage. It must be both. And that's what Jesus is sending them to do. He's sending them to make sure they're comprehensively covering both ends of this polarity, to both preach and heal. Which leads to the third most interesting thing about this mission. It begins just before verse, I can't read my thing anymore, verse 8, 8b, or right before verse 9. My eyes are getting worse and worse as I get older. I guess that comes with it, right? Freely you have received, freely give. Which is to say, no charge. This is not for sale. This is not a commodity. You're not producing widgets. This is not a business. You're not trying to sell stuff. You're not trying to get rich. You're not trying to, you know, make this great thing. You are coming to give freely what you have freely given. How do you display that behaviorally? Well, verse 9. Don't take along any gold or silver or copper in your belts. Take no bag for the journey or extra tunic or sandals or a staff, for the worker is worthy of his keep. Now, you can have a lot of fun with this passage. Don't take any money. Don't worry about the resources. Just go out. He's already told us, worry about just today. Tomorrow has enough troubles. Don't worry about, you know, what you're going to eat and all this. So now they're going to have to go live it, just like he already is. And then he says, take no bag for the journey, because you're not going to go and accumulate stuff. Don't take an extra tunic. One's enough. And it seems like it's not don't take extra sandals or a staff, but don't take sandals or a staff, which means barefoot, vulnerable. Coming in a way that is so free of the symbols of material wealth and excess baggage that the best word you could use for it, for us, would be travel light. Don't get bogged down. Don't get overloaded. Don't try to amass so much that you have, you know, things coming out the side. There is this incredible freeness to it because there's a trust in God's provision and there's an awareness that you can't freely give unless you know you freely receive. So they're going to have to live this message in order to pass on this message. And those who receive them need to know they really are doing a work. The worker is worth his keep. They actually are doing a work that has value. They're preaching and they are healing and they're bringing hope and they're bringing help. And people that receive them will hopefully support them. So it's not as if there's no support, but they're counting on the support of those that they minister to and help. So much so that if they don't get support, they need to move on. Verse 11. Whatever town or village you enter, search for some worthy person there and stay at his house until you leave. As you enter the home, give it your greeting. If the home is deserving, let your peace rest on it. If it's not, let your peace return to you. If anyone will not welcome you or listen to your words, shake the dust off your feet when you leave that home or town. What's interesting about that is we're going to Israel. The custom of the day is when a Jew would go and walk through Samaria, or they'd walk through a Gentile town, or they'd be in a marketplace where there was a lot of Gentile influence. When they would get out of the Gentile area, they'd shake the dust of their feet as a sign of disgust, that they're cleaning themselves up and moving on to get rid of that contamination that they've encountered from the Gentiles. But in this case, the contamination's from Jews. It's from their fellow Israelites who don't want anything to do with it. And Jesus essentially says, move on. Don't sweat it. Just move on. Wipe the dust from your feet. And know that they have been given a great responsibility because they had a chance. Verse 15, I tell you the truth, it'll be more bearable for Sodom and Gomorrah on that day of judgment than for that town. So that they have received much and they're going to be accountable for much. So there's the essence of the nature of the mission. It is focused for Jesus and these apostles. It's the lost sheep of Israel. For us, it will become all the world. It is a ministry of preaching and healing, and it is freely given because it's freely been received. Which leads to some perils as we close out this manual for mission. Because even though these apostles now have the power to fend off demons, they have the power to heal, they don't have the power to fend off persecution. That's not in their power skill set. And so Jesus says something that way back in the day, I must have quoted this passage to Terry hundreds of times. Hundreds of times. I use this so much, she eventually asked me, where's it at in the Bible, so she could prove that it really was in the Bible. Because I used it all the time. I believe it's a very important verse. Verse 16, I'm sending you out like sheep among wolves. Therefore, be shrewd as serpents and innocent as doves. Sheep, serpents, doves. That's quite a mix. It's quite a menagerie of animals. And the one thing you know is, well, we didn't include wolves, But the wolves are the persecution that's always going to be outlying there when you try to do good. Those who are committed to not doing good will resist and oppose and raise, you know, the fangs and claws. And you knew, though, this, if it's a versus situation like Batman versus Superman, although here it's sheep versus wolves, I'd lay all my money on the wolves. Sheep don't win. If they survive in a match between sheep versus wolves, it'd be miraculous. Because sheep surrounded by wolves, you know, you might as well say, bye-bye, sheep. It was nice knowing you. Because the sheep is going to be slaughtered. So Jesus tells them, you know, you're going into a situation that's dangerous, that's risky, that's challenging. It's not going to be easy. So you need to have street smarts. And this is how I'd always kind of bring it over to Terry. We need to be as wise and as crafty as serpents. Think about the situations we're in. Think about it. Let's not be naive. Let's not assume because we're doing good, people will want to do good back to us. Let's not assume that because we're trying to do the right thing, everyone's going to be happy. So you got to be shrewd as a serpent, but innocent as dove, which means you refuse to use the strategies of a serpent to bring peace. So if someone attacks you like a serpent, you don't attack back. But you're trying to have the street smarts that allows you to know, let's not be naive about this mission we're on. It involves numerous challenges. And we need to have, not naivety, but street smarts about us. And we might need to be just as crafty as that old serpent in the garden every once in a while. But we always must accompany that with the absolute innocence and peacemaking of a dove. You know, we got to be serpent doves. That kind of sounds cool now that I think about it. I mean, but that's a whole other story. That just came to my mind. So there's perils. And that's where Jesus makes it very clear there will be challenges, but there's always a silver lining. You're going to suffer, but there's always a silver lining, even in the suffering. So in verse 17, be on your guard against men. They will hand you over to the local councils and flog you in the synagogues. On my account, you'll be brought before governors and kings as witnesses to them and to the Gentiles. But when they arrest you, do not worry about what to say or how to say it. At that time, you will be given what to say. Now, in the disciples' ministry during Jesus' earthly ministry, none of these things will happen to them. At least nothing that's recorded. After Jesus has risen, a lot of this will happen to Paul and Peter and others. 11 of the 12 apostles are martyrs. The 12th they just couldn't kill. They tried to kill John the seer, John, but they couldn't. So they had to exile him to Patmos. But according to tradition, they will all face something like this. But you know who will face all of that in this gospel? Jesus. Jesus is just flat out stating what is going to happen to him. But he's warning them that this, because they are representatives of him, will eventually happen to him as well. But he says, here's the silver lining. Verse 18, I passed by it. On my account, you'll be brought before governors and kings. And the silver lining is you get to witness of the kingdom. What is truth? My kingdom is the truth. My kingdom's not of this world. Who do you say that I am? You know, you get a chance to witness, so the witness isn't stopped by the suffering. The witness carries on. There's another silver lining, verse 20, for it will not be you speaking, but the Spirit of your Father speaking through you. So as you're standing for the truth, God's not going to abandon you. The Spirit will come, the Spirit will support and strengthen, guide, and even inspire you to say what needs to be said. Know that it's challenging, and this gets some real tough words. Verse 21, brother will betray brother to death, father his child, children rebel against their parents, have them put to death. All men will hate you because of me, but he who stands firm to the end will be saved. So here's the third silver lining, endurance, endure to the end, stand firm. You don't grow in endurance without some hardship. You know, all sunshine makes a desert, as my old pastor used to say. That the only way you thrive and grow and learn endurance is when you exercise the muscles of faith again and again. And when you have to keep the faith in difficult situations, you start learning that key quality and virtue of enduring, patiently standing firm, holding on to the faith when everything around you is saying not to. And then, very practical silver lining, verse 23, when you're persecuted in one place, flee to another. It's my favorite. You know, get it out of there. If they persecute you here, Jesus doesn't say just stay there and be a martyr for martyr's sake, you know. Instead, if you can, get out of there. So, where's the silver lining? Well, you might go to another place where there's another opportunity to witness and to preach and to heal. So that, you know, you're moving to just another mission field, another place to harvest. I tell you the truth, you will not finish going through the cities of Israel before the Son of Man comes. The reason why all this happens, verse 24, a student's not above his teacher, nor a servant above his master. It is enough for the student to be like his teacher and the servant like his master. If the head of the house is being called Beelzebub, and we've already seen it, he drives out demons by the prince of demons. If Jesus has already been called Beelzebub, the Lord of the flies, the evil one, how much more the members of his household? So Jesus makes it very clear, if you're my representatives, you share in my ministry, you will probably share in my suffering. That makes a whole lot of sense of passages that you'll read in the New Testament where Paul will say, I want to know him and to share in his sufferings, because Paul understands that that goes hand in hand. Or 2 Corinthians 1, which I read at every funeral, that we have had our share of the comfort of Christ and the sufferings of Christ. That they both come together, that they are part of that growing and following in the way of the Christ, which is all comes together in that one metaphor of take up your cross, which he's going to say before this chapter's out. That if we're going to follow in the way of the crucified one, then we're going to both heal and preach and witness and testify and triumph in the end, but we may suffer along the way. And so he says you need to be ready for that. Which, you know, takes a lot away from so much verbiage that goes on in, again, leadership books about being relevant and making sure everyone likes us and all of this, which I don't want to be a jerk to people and I don't want to be unliked, but I want to be faithful first and foremost. And I think that has to always have the top shelf. And we need to know that not everyone's going to be incredibly pleased by doing good, by seeking the welfare of the helpless and the harmed and the hopeless. They're not going to be absolutely pleased by a group of people that come together claiming to follow Jesus and perhaps in some ways denouncing the powers that surround us that don't seek the welfare of this world. That then leads to the final peril, which really is Jesus' final encouragement. Because we do know, if we're talking about a manual for missions, and we see the nature of the mission, and we have heard about some of the perils, the biggest challenge for all of us is going to be, well, I'm afraid. And we know for a fact that the primary cause for failure of discipleship will always be fear. Fear is the opposite of faith. It's when the what ifs. What if we go out and are persecuted? What if we go out and we don't get support? What if we go out and they don't take us in? All those what-ifs can control and fear can dominate and faithfulness takes a walk. And so Jesus wants to make sure that they know their biggest opponent may not be the outside world that terrifies them. It might be the fears that immobilize them before they even get started. So he says in verse 26, don't be afraid of them. Here's three reasons he's going to give, and I love all three of these reasons, although they are told in a way that's just, you know, candid and blunt. First, there's nothing concealed that will not be disclosed or hidden that will not be made known. What I tell you in the dark, speak in the daylight. What's whispered in your ear, proclaim from the roofs. If you're highly sensitive in your conscience, you might think, oh no, all those dirty little secrets Jesus is talking about, they're going to be exposed. That's not his point here in the context. The point is, if you go out and faithfully seek to witness and follow Christ, what's going to be known in the end, no matter what the opposition and persecution is God will proclaim, well done, good and faithful servant. That's the idea. That what you might have thought got lost in all of that challenge of persecution and suffering was not lost at all, but God remembered every cup of cold water, every good work, every good deed, that God says, you know, it's not going to be forgotten. It's not going to be forgotten. So understand that. Then, secondly, verse 28, before I read it, essentially Jesus is going to say, the worst they can do is kill you. All right? So verse 28, do not be afraid of those who kill the body but cannot kill the soul. Rather be afraid of the one who can destroy both soul and body in hell. People always want to, you know, rinse Jesus of anything that's potentially, you know, offensive. Oh my gosh. But this is Jesus. And he says, you know what? Why would you fear them when the most they can do is kill you? God is the one who is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God of the living, the God that is able to bring life from the dead. The most they can do is kill you. But you are a servant of God's. And even that can't thwart God. So, hold in higher reverence the fear of God. Because if you fear man more than you fear God, then you will succumb to your fears toward man. Instead, he says, make your highest reverence, your highest devotion, your greatest sense of humility toward the God who holds all in God's hands. So that's the real blunt one. And then here's the one we all kind of gravitate toward because it feels more sentimental and it's a beautiful, really. Verse 29, are not two sparrows sold for a penny, yet not one of them will fall to the ground apart from the will of your Father. And even the very head of your hairs are all numbered. So don't be afraid. So it began with don't be afraid, verse 26. It ends with don't be afraid. You're worth more than many sparrows. And essentially Jesus says, you know what? God, your Father, who I've been talking about, who will only give gifts to His children, who loves you immensely, whom you can pray to and approach as Abba, loves you so intensely and intimately and loyally that God knows every detail and cares about every detail, cares about every tear, cares about every moment of suffering, cares about every courageous moment you've had where you stood for faithfulness rather than fear. God holds all those preciously, knows those details, and the God who knows all that will not allow you to lose in the end. You are known so intimately that nothing in the world can eradicate God's loving care for you and over you. So don't fear them. You will be vindicated. You are loved. So it's a beautiful way to bring comfort and to try to challenge that objection of fear that arises from all of us. Now let's round this out because I'm going much longer than I thought I would. So let's speed through everything but the end here because this goes to the very end. Essentially, verse 32 through 39 is him bringing out the fact that Jesus and the gospel has our first priority. And so he wants us to know, make sure that you don't disown me, acknowledge me before men. There's going to be challenges, man against his father. He's already said that. Make sure you seek first the kingdom. And so that should put other priorities in place. And verse 38, anyone who does not take up his cross and follow me is not worthy of me. So he's inviting us to not only represent and to share in the healing and preaching ministry, but know that may bring suffering. But here's the beautiful truth. Whoever finds his life will lose it. Whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. Now we end with this wonderful revelation that you have 12 apostles, wonderfully gifted, given great authority. What about all those who support the apostles? What about all those who aren't the apostles and yet might want to be part of this? And he says in verse 40, "Here, he who receives you receives me, and he who receives me receives the one who sent me." That means receives God. Anyone who receives a prophet, now he's calling the apostles prophets, because he is a prophet, will receive a prophet's reward. And anyone who receives a righteous man, because he's a righteous man, will receive a righteous man reward. So the people that receive the apostles, they get the same reward, if you will. They get the same recognition. God honors them and honors their faith and vindicates their faithfulness in just the same way. So much so that verse 42, if anyone gives even a cup of cold water to one of these little ones because he's my disciple, I tell you the truth, he will certainly not lose his reward. So that all those that are part of this kingdom community that is going out to bring hope and to healing are all treasured and valued and cherished and vindicated and rewarded because it's God's kingdom that will prevail in the end. And so everyone is invited to have a role in it, whether big apostolic or small, just a small support role of, you know, here's the cup of cold water. I think of someone running a 26-mile marathon and what Jesus is essentially saying, the person that's sticking along the way and puts out the cup of cold water, they get the same ribbon at the end. Because they're all part of this same, they're all sharing together. It's not a competition. They're all joining in this movement of Christ, in this movement of the kingdom. So if you put all this together, What makes a missional church? Clearly, to preach and to heal are important. There should be signs of the kingdom that go along with the declaration of the kingdom. There's certainly a self-denying quality. They're not in it for the money. They are to freely give. I got too many quotes, but I'm still going to show this one. So they are to freely give. The disciples, Stanley Saunders, which has a commentary I read, the disciples' mission employs intentional poverty, defensiveness, and dependence on God in order to illustrate the true source, nature, and power of the empire they proclaim. This is a hard word for prosperous Christians in the modern world where we're accustomed to stable, secure, even endowed religious institutions. We're endowed, we're used to kind of amassing our resources and making sure we have enough, not to just going out in the mission and realizing that we're just giving freely of what we freely received. There's a call to suffer and yet remain faithful. Clearly, Jesus never underestimates the reality of suffering, but he invites us to stick to our faith in the midst of it. And then there's a final call to make sure that fear doesn't win in the end, because God's love wins. And so we cling tightly to nothing shall ever separate us from the love of God in Christ, neither death nor life nor angels nor principalities nor powers nor anything to come nor anything that's past. Nothing can separate us from the love of God, which Luther put so well in, "The body they may kill, God's truth abideth still, his kingdom is forever, in his mighty fortress is our God." So we're called to a mission. And the mission is pretty clear in here. Now, it can take many forms, but those essential elements need to be in place in order to make sure that we are performing the mission of God. So that when we think about a manual for mission, Stanley gets the final word. Today, many congregations and denominations struggle to identify their mission and calling. The thing we must take care of is when mission devolves into forms of institutional self-preservation or self-aggrandizement, when it's all about us, Matthew's summary of the nature of Christian mission cuts to the core. And I think what Matthew invites us to do is to see the crowds as Jesus did. He saw with compassion. It invites us to have the kind of diversity Matthew's disciples have, of zealots right alongside of those in league with Rome. It invites us to realize that we're called to freely give and to not always calculate and make sure that we've got all we need in order to move forward, but to move forward in faith and hope without fear. Because if we lose the mission, if we lose that, those essential elements, preaching and teaching, freely giving, being ready to suffer but remaining faithful nonetheless and not giving into fear, if we lose that, we lose everything. We lose the mission. We lose joining in what the risen Christ is doing in our world. So, there's the manual on mission. It's awesome, huh? I love it. Worship team, if you'd come forward, let me tell you where we're going in 2 weeks, just so particularly our confirmands can know where we're going. Next week is Ash Wednesday. That means we have our Ash Wednesday service here. There's an Ash Wednesday dinner at 6 that the youth are providing, and then at 7 we have our Ash Wednesday service. It's going to be a tough one this year, but we're having it. And then next 2 weeks from now, we will pick up with chapter 11, because just like before, there are two chapters of activities, and then we have the third extended discourse, which is the parables of the kingdom, which is so much fun. I can't wait to get there, because we'll have fun with that one. I have a plan on what we'll do to make that hopefully interesting.